This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is In Our Time. Today's podcast deals with the issue of transparency, a subject that seems much connected to the world of information technology and network and databases. As with so much in this podcast, it not only looks at the things which may be transparent, it also wonders what things are not. It is entitled The Age of Accountability. Long before he started to cry, long before he bowed his head in a vain effort to recover his composure, you could tell that Akio Toyoda was in trouble. He was, to be sure, engaged in one of the more difficult rituals of the industrialized world. When a company seems to be doing something wrong, when its products aren't working quite as advertised, we call its top executives to sit in front of a congressional committee and ask them to account for their organization. We now live in an age of transparency. We believe that when decisions are made in public, or at least explained in public, that they'll be more rational, more thoughtful, and best able to provide the greatest good to the greatest number of people. Toyoda was making his public explanation because of a perceived failure of transparency. The prior months were filled with reports that his company's automobiles were experiencing failures of design or manufacture. A company representative identified a problem with a mechanical part and blamed a supplier. News reports suggested that an electronic circuit might have failed, or perhaps the software in an engine controller. In a congressional hearing, a chief executive officer must be transparent in almost a ceremonial way, humble, open to criticism, expressing gratitude to be able to speak to representatives of the American people. In these meetings, it's best to confess to problems that are vague and unlikely to draw legal action. In recent months, following an unfortunate appearance by heads of the American automakers before Congress, a new step has been added to this ritual. In their testimony, CEOs must now make a statement that makes them seem like an ordinary citizen, a middle-class consumer of the company's products. The CEOs of the American car companies chose to drive their own vehicles from Detroit to Washington, D.C., in penance for the mistake of flying on corporate jets to an earlier hearing. Toyoda decided to claim that he occasionally tested the company's products. "I myself am a trained test driver," he explained. "As a professional, I am able to check on problems in a car and can understand how severe the safety concern is in a car." But, of course, Toyoda is, in fact, a professional CEO, and he is responsible for the standard tasks of a corporate leader. He has to deal with stock prices, finance issues, coordination of production, strategic plans, long-term investments. If he does that job properly, he would have little energy or attention left to devote to contributing to a proper test program. The real signs that Toyota's talk was going to end badly came when he briefly opened his company doors to praise his employees and then slammed them shut before any questions could be asked. "At Toyota," he proclaimed, "we believe the key to making quality products is to develop quality people." It's a pleasant statement, a remark that identified him with the 200,000 individuals who work for his company. However, it was yet one more comment that attempted to be transparent without actually being transparent, to satisfy the form without providing the understanding. While good employees are certainly better than bad employees, Employees, good and bad, are less important than a good organization. The collection of people, relationships, and information systems and protocols that are at the heart of a modern company. A good organization can get quality results from mediocre employees. A bad organization can accomplish nothing, no matter how talented its people may be. Well, not long ago, a beautiful spring day brought a complete organizational failure to my front door. The people were skilled, well-equipped, and possessed of the best intentions. Yet, they lacked an organization that would allow them to accomplish the task that befell them. The problem began when power failed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Computer screens went black. Hard drives ground to a halt with a stream of bad bits written across the most recently addressed files. The internet dribbled a few last packets onto the floor and then ceased to function. For a few minutes, 10 at most, the 200,000 people who worked and lived in my neighborhood behaved like good employees. They sat patiently at their desks. They fiddled with the switches. They wandered into the department manager's office to see if anyone knew what was happening. Had the technical problem been quickly resolved, we all would have missed a beautiful day and the subsequent excitement. However, nothing seemed to be happening. So, one by one, we all locked our desks, skipped into the lovely afternoon, and joined a traffic jam that would not be cleared for 6 hours. Not only did the offices lack power, so did the stoplights. Of course, plenty of good people were on hand to fix the problem. Metropolitan police, university police, park police, and parking police, two very different groups. Military police, security police, even business district police, not to mention the crossing guards at the local middle school. All were well-trained. All had good equipment, white gloves, shrill whistles, and attitudes that could force an aggressive driver to cower in fear. These police had all that they could want, except for an organization that would coordinate their actions. They moved quickly through the streets and took command of the corner that was nearest to their regular duty station. They tried to move traffic in an efficient, orderly manner until they found that there was nothing that they could do. They couldn't see their colleagues at other intersections and hence couldn't make decisions that would keep the traffic flowing. The era of manual traffic control is long past. In the modern age, it's controlled by a combination of centralized servers, software models, sensors, and switched lights. A team of cops, no matter how well trained, can't improve that kind of organization. In the aftermath of that great spring traffic nightmare, people called for investigations and more transparency in the police departments. For several weeks, they searched for a scapegoat, an individual who could take the communal blame and be banished into the woods. Perhaps someone had failed to give the right command. Perhaps someone had failed to develop an appropriate plan. Perhaps someone was eating a donut at the crucial moment. Transparency, so they thought, would solve the problem. While perhaps some strategic planning committee had indeed failed to imagine the crisis of the day, the failure was also organizational. At that time, our city's collected security forces did not have an organization that could anticipate such problems and devise human structures that could address them. In many ways, the auto industry had struggled with organizational structures that lingered over problems of the past rather than anticipated the needs of their future. For more than 60 years, the organizational for the industry was provided by General Motors. which was assembled between 1915 and 1922, from a collection of small companies. Its leaders tried to create a unified organization that would minimize the complexity of manufacture by combining technical protocols with market forces. General Motors has become an essay in federalism, wrote management expert Peter Drucker in 1947. It attempts to combine the greatest corporate unity with the greatest divisional autonomy and responsibility. GM's structure was created by Alfred P. Sloan, who developed his ideas in response to the economic conditions in the early decades of the 20th century. He wanted a company that would contract during economic recessions, such as that of 1922, expand for growing markets, such as that of 1925 and 26, and rapidly change production for war, as General Motors did in 1939. In the middle of the 20th century, Drucker, viewing this structure, argued that General Motors' organization enables all units of the company to produce more efficiently and at lower cost than any of them could as independent units. GM's corporate structure worked fairly well through the early 1960s, when its principal concern was meeting the demand for automobiles. However, the organization found it difficult to meet the additional demands that appeared in the 60s and the 70s. Specifically, it didn't know how to react to the consumer push for safer cars, and it resisted calls to reduce atmospheric pollution and increase gas mileage. Where it should have moved long before of its own volition, wrote journalist David Halberstam, the industry now slowly and reluctantly moved, forced by public demand. GM, along with the rest of the auto industry, reluctantly entered the digital age in 1980, when it installed digital controls on its products to comply with U.S. air pollution and fuel efficiency standards. In general, the industry treated digital components as simply another part or subsystem. A computer was just another bolt or gear or brake pad. No one in the auto industry thought that perhaps they should organize their cars around their information flow rather than their information flow around their cars. While software modularity is commonplace in software engineering, observed a recent industry report, it is far from practice in the automotive industry, where the electronic systems architecture follows company organization and automotive supply chains. The senior engineers of the major auto manufacturers argued that they had good reason for avoiding the modern tools of software engineering. They claimed that their methods, their older standard methods, encouraged clear identification of responsibilities and liabilities. Hence, they clung to those older information infrastructures, even as their products became more and more complex. Engineers learned to patch new elements into old systems, route multiple buses through a single connection, and gather extra information from an overworked sensor. Organizations tend to make major changes only when they face a crisis. Hence, we may remember the financial unpleasantness of 2009-2010 as the event that created the new organizational models for the automotive industry. Yet, a number of engineers and managers have been anticipating that they may need to create new and more transparent information structure for all stages of the automotive lifecycle: design, manufacture, distribution, operation, and ultimately, disposal. Since 2000, they've been working on a new automotive information environment that recognizes that automobiles are merely multiprocessors on wheels. Multiprocessors that are part of a large, pervasive computing structure. At the core of this work is known as the Automotive Open Software Architecture, or AUTOSAR. Like many an industrial initiative, AUTOSAR is an effort to build a common technological environment in a way that lets everyone who contributes to that environment use it without paying royalties or worrying about patent infringements. While it identifies several common technical goals, such as a standard means of communication and a common development environment, it really has organizational goals. It seeks to end the isolation of individual engineers, as well as the programs that they use to sense, to store, and to manipulate data. It gives them a flexible means of communicating and cooperating, so they're less likely to be an array of well-trained professionals who can't solve a complicated problem because the right hand can't see what the left hand is doing. Perhaps most importantly, it changes the relation of the past to the future. For 30 years, the annual change of automotive models has been a barrier to improvement, forcing engineers to devote their effort to making new elements work with existing software. Mature reaction on component design changes, explains one expert. Reuse of software, identical design rules across all users, concentration on the innovations, and last but not least, the safe handling of complexity is our target. We tend to look at initiatives such as AUTOSAR as merely technological development, new opportunities for gaining more control over the material world and using that control for our benefit. In fact, such things are also organizational projects. They provide us with new ways of dividing labor for the manufacture and operation of our products. As we conceive our cars around information, we'll structure our design teams differently. Owners will have new relationships with their mechanics. Manufacturers will have new connections to their fleet in the field. All of these connections will involve large amounts of data and will offer new kinds of transparency. It will be harder to claim that a car hasn't failed when the data from the entire fleet reveals a problem. It'll be equally difficult to ascribe the blame to others when this new transparency reveals dangerous driving habits or incomplete maintenance. At the same time, this developing transparency will require outsiders to understand the nature of the data flow within the automotive environment. The data will have to be interpreted in the context of the organization that produced it. Furthermore, the time will come when we will again be reminded that we'll encounter situations that can't be solved by our definition of transparency, that some problem will develop within the system in a way that we couldn't have foreseen and can't address. At such a point, we'll see another auto executive sitting in front of a government board and trying to appear transparent. Following the script, he or she will be humble, open to criticism, grateful to speak to the representatives of the people, willing to confess to a problem that really isn't much of a problem. Perhaps that person will cry. Perhaps not. That may not be part of what happens in that particular age of transparency and accountability. You've been listening to In Our Time. This podcast was based on an essay in the May 2010 issue of Computer Magazine, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about both the Computer Society and Computer Magazine can be found at www.computer.com. To find the information about Computer, click on the Publications tab and look for Technical Magazines. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at this site. Scroll to the bottom and you'll see them there. If you have any comments, we'd love to hear them. You can send them to podcasts@computer.org. The music for this podcast, by the way, came from Music Alley, which is a PodSafe music source. You can find it at musicalley.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.